From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, some observations about theater and the movies from David Mamet. He has a new collection of essays called Make Believe Town. He'll also tell us about one of his early jobs, writing fantasies for a men's magazine. Also, The Boys in the Band, the 1968 play and 1970 movie adaptation, were praised for dealing with a formerly taboo subject, homosexuality, but were criticized for their stereotypical characters. Now the play is revived off-Broadway. We'll meet playwright Mark Crowley. TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new PBS series, Signal to Noise, and rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the music genre known as techno. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
I'm Craig Windham. North Carolina Governor Jim Hunt has declared a state of emergency in 34 coastal counties that could be in the path of Hurricane Bertha, which is now about 300 miles south of Wilmington. The storm is packing 100-mile-an-hour winds. Ray Sturza is with the Dare County, North Carolina Emergency Services Department.
Right now, the projections are that the storm is going to make landfall somewhere between Wilmington and Moorhead City, North Carolina. And the storm seems to be wobbling on its track, and every time its forward speed slows or it wobbles a little more, it increases the likelihood that it'll go into the Pamlico Sound, which is the backside of the Barrier Islands here in Dare County, and that's not good.
In South Carolina, Governor David Beasley is expected to order a mandatory evacuation of the Grand Strand area that includes Myrtle Beach. Forecasters are predicting that Bertha will make landfall early tomorrow. A report by two congressional subcommittees on the 1993 siege at the Branch Davidian compound near Waco, Texas, finds that Attorney General Janet Reno's decision to force an end to the standoff was highly irresponsible. But the two Republican chairmen of the panel said cult leader David Koresh bore the ultimate responsibility for the deaths of some 80 people in the fires at the compound, fires that evidence indicates were intentionally set by members of the Branch Davidians. Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott says his patience is wearing thin with Democratic stalling tactics on the floor of the Senate. Lott says if the holdups aren't resolved soon, he may resort to a confrontation. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
2 days after Senate Republicans allowed the minimum wage increase to come to the floor, Lott says gridlock seems to have returned to the Senate. Besides the health care bill, he cited a taxpayer's bill of rights and legal fees for fired White House travel office workers that have been blocked. Lott says if he has to, he'll force Democrats to stay on the floor around the clock and carry out their threatened filibusters.
At some point, if I don't get cooperation and if there is continued gridlock here in the Senate, then I'm going to have to force debate that people threaten to show the American people where the problem is.
Minority Leader Tom Daschle says Lott doesn't do himself or the Senate any good by pointing fingers. He says Democrats will continue to push for compromises on health care and other bills. I'm Peter Kenyon at the Capitol.
A year ago today, Bosnian Serb forces overran the town of Srebrenica. Today, UN teams were back at work unearthing more bodies from mass grave sites near the town. Investigators believe the Serbs killed up to 7,000 Muslim civilians during the conquest of Srebrenica. Stock prices are in a deep free fall today after Hewitt Packard Corporation announced that its orders will hurt profits in the next quarter. Currently on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down over 80 points in heavy trading at 5,523. On the NASDAQ, the composite index is down nearly 33 points. You're listening to news from NPR. President Clinton is proposing a $5 billion plan to repair school buildings across the nation. White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry says the program is designed to help school districts finance the cost of repairs and new construction. Mr. Clinton will announce the four-year program in a ceremony at the White House today. The plan would be financed with proceeds from government auctions of communications licenses. The Vice President and the Acting Surgeon General have released a report extolling the benefits of moderate exercise. NPR's Joanne Silberner has the story.
The report, timed for release a week before the Olympics, will urge Americans to get up off their duffs. Physical inactivity is a serious public health problem, according to Acting Surgeon General Audrey Manley. The report will say that 30 minutes a day of even moderate exercise is a good idea. And it's generous with what constitutes moderate exercise. It includes walking or washing and waxing a car or pushing a stroller. To promote the report, the Vice President, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and the Acting Surgeon General will take a brisk walk down Pennsylvania Avenue. While the government is touting the report as the equivalent of the 1964 Surgeon General's report on smoking, other government agencies have issued similar conclusions on the benefits of moderate exercise. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
A top Russian commander was killed today when his armored truck hit a landmine in Chechnya, where Russian troops have stepped up their air and artillery attacks against towns controlled by separatist rebels. A Russian military spokesman says the attacks are to punish the rebels for their violations of a ceasefire signed in May. Dozens of civilians have reportedly been killed in the offensive. Israeli soldiers battled with rock-throwing Palestinians who tried to enter Israel from the West Bank today without proper work permits. Over two dozen people were reportedly injured. Thousands of Palestinian workers lost their jobs in February when Israel blocked them from entering the country from the West Bank and Gaza Strip after a wave of suicide bombings. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of America's greatest living playwrights got his start writing fantasies for a men's magazine. That's just one of the things we learn about David Mamet in his new collection of essays and remembrances called Make Believe Town. He also tells about some of his earliest professional experiences in the theater, shares his thoughts on why the quality of screenplays is degenerating, and insists that art is not meant to be ennobling. And what's a David Mamet collection without one good essay about a poker game? Mamet's plays include Glengarry Glen Ross, Oleana, Speed the Plow, and American Buffalo. He wrote and directed the films House of Games, Things Change, and Homicide, and wrote the screenplays for The Untouchables, The Verdict, and Hoffa. Let's start with a reading from his essay, Girl Copy, about the year he spent in the mid-70s writing for the men's magazine called We.
All over the country, adolescent boys and frustrated married men were looking at sexy photos of sexy naked women, and these men were having fantasies about them. Here I was getting 20 grand a year to look at the same photos and create those fantasies, and it felt to me like work. I would be given the blues, blue and gray first runs of what would later be glorious color spreads of the said naked women, and I would tack them on the cork-lined walls, and I would strive to have fantasies about them. For it was all a fiction, all that stuff. Their names were made up, their biographies, their likes and peeves. It was whole cloth, like the letters to the editor. Somebody made it up, and that year, that was my job. I think my personal best was Katya with her pants down, and there was also Anna is a palindrome, but I'm not sure if that was mine. I did write, Tolstoy said that a nap after dinner is silver, a nap before dinner is gold. Gretchen prefers a nap to dinner altogether, workmanlike, as you see.
David Mamet, did working at this men's magazine help you at all as a writer or prepare you for the future in any way?
It paid the rent. That was a great help. And it was humbling in that a lot of the stuff was difficult for me to do, and I had to apply myself to it because I was getting paid for it, which is different than writing completely on one's own. If something's not working, you can just say, oh, heck, I believe I'll have another cup of coffee. And also, in a certain way, it gave me confidence because the editor of the magazine at that time, Mark Zussman, came to me and he said, this is something you can do. I'd like you to work at the magazine, although you've never done it before. And you'll pick it up as you go along. So that, in the long run, gave me a lot of confidence.
Now, were you the young, budding, serious writer at the magazine?
Oh, no, we were all the young, budding, serious writer. That was one of the nice things about working at the magazine. Everybody was a serious writer to boot, and he or she, and a lot of women who worked there, was working there to pay the rent. And everyone took it very, very seriously and was quite conscientious. And it was a great atmosphere.
Now, when you were making up these fantasies for the nude photos, why couldn't you write your own fantasies?
Well, because I was trying too hard. I mean, I'd fallen into, I think, the error of a lot of beginning writers, which I'd never experienced before, because I just picked up a pencil and a piece of paper and sat down and started writing plays. Never occurred to me that there was a right way to do it, because I was somewhere between an autodidact and an idiot savant. But then when I came to working for the magazine, I thought, well, okay, I must apply myself. I must think harder, think better, which is, of course, the death of all inspiration.
Now, you also, well, if you weren't writing your own fantasies, did you feel like you had to make up other people's? In other words, did you start writing things that You didn't believe for a second?
Well, I don't know. I think I went back and forth between trying to be too cute and trying to be correct. And as I say later on in this essay, most of my time when I was working in that magazine was devoted to my own inner fantasies about what must go on at that magazine at night right. after everybody goes home and why I was being excluded. And I could never make the connection between those rampantly libidinous fantasies and the work which I was getting paid to do. If I'd put them together, I would have been able to go home earlier.
So do you think other people actually had a wild sex life outside of the office?
Well, actually, I was having a wild sex life outside of the office, but and I'm sure they were too, but neither mine nor theirs had anything to do with the work at the office.
David Mamet is my guest. He has a new collection of essays called Make Believe Town. You have another essay in your new collection that's what's actually the title essay, Make Believe Town, and it's all about screenplays and writing screenplays and what writing screenplays has become. And you say that nowadays screenplays are really written for bored script readers instead of being written for the directors who are actually going to make the movies. Who are the script readers, and how do you think this is changing the way screenplays are written?
The script readers are bright young people from the better universities, because they're very coveted jobs, and they're like boot camp for studio people, where the entering aspirants, so the entering employees, are inducted into the ethos of the organization, which is to accept the predictable only and to ratify only the predictable. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, movie business is a business just like any other, and these people are as entitled to their rice bowl as I or you. It's just it becomes kind of frustrating as a writer to deal with them.
Give me an example of the kind of writing that you think is written for bored script writers that doesn't really make sense in a screenplay, that doesn't really work in a screenplay.
Well, I'll give you an example which may seem bizarre or gratuitous, but to me sums up the whole problem. For example, if you say, here's a new screen, we're going to stop one scene. It says, blah, 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 she gets up from the table and closes the door. Next scene, interior restaurant, later. Well, this makes sense if it's a novel, but the question which the director has to ask is, how do we know it's later? It's very fine on the page to say, how do we know it's later? But if it's important for the audience to know it's later, it's the job of the scriptwriter to tell the director how the audience will understand it's later. Because the screenplay finally is not a novel. It's, as I say, it's a schematic.
Right, right. Now, you also write about sex scenes within movies and how the narrative in some films is just a kind of function of transition to get from one sex scene or one violence scene to another. Right. It seems that sex scenes also just make you uncomfortable, as not only as a filmmaker but as a viewer.
Yeah, they do. Because I love actors. I spent my whole life with actors. They're my closest friends. They're my extended family. My wife is an actress, and to ask an actor or an actress to do those scenes is It's not acting. It's pretending. It's engaging in some form of pornography. It's to ask them to pretend to have sex. And as I say in the essay, if you look closely, you'll see that they're really not enjoying it, and they're faking it because of how could one not? I mean, why would one want to take one's deepest feelings, which have nothing whatever to do with the movie, and parade them for the sake of employment?
Do you think that erotic scenes are almost always gratuitous in movies?
Well, I don't know. I mean, a lot has been written and said over the years about the difference between eroticism and pornography, meaning eroticism is what I like and pornography is what you like. So, I mean, there's some deeply I'm trying to think of a wonderful erotic moment in a movie. I probably could, as soon as the program's over, I'm going to go home and think about it. Are they always gratuitous? I'll tell you what they are. Is that it's always very, very easy. And it's like they used to say, and they still say, it's become part of the American language, cut to the chase. What that meant is when you don't know what to do, you cut to the wagon rolling down the hill, or the guy riding for the sheriff, or the girl escaping from the villain running down the railroad track. That's what you do when you don't know what to do. Another thing you can do when you don't know what to do is cut to a scene of people pretending to have sex with each other.
My guest is playwright, screenwriter, and director David Mamet. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. David Mamet is my guest. His new collection of essays is called Make Believe Town. Now, you've updated Chekhov. You've done contemporary translations of Chekhov for instance, Uncle Vanya. And our listeners might have seen that on Vanya on 42nd Street, which used your adaptation.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about what it's been like to update Chekhov? Did you go back to the original Russian or to English translations of it?
Well, I mean, I don't know that I updated it. Perhaps I did, but what I did, I've done three of the four major plays, and I haven't done The Seagull, but I hope to do that this year, God willing, was I went back and commissioned or had commissioned a literal translation from the Russian by a commercial translator or the equivalent, as if it were a dry document, where I was able to get, I was very lucky in the people who worked with me on this, able to get an alternative reading of a phrase, the connotation of a phrase, the associations that one might have with the phrase or a word. And I was told by all of these people that the writing in Russian is very, very straightforward and simple. And I found it rather easy to do and quite a lot of fun. I don't know that I felt like I was updating it, but perhaps that's what I was doing.
What did you want to do with it?
I wanted to capture my understanding, which of course not speaking Russian is going to be maculate at best, of the dramatic rhythm involved in the plays. I mean, I spent a lot of time living up in a small town in the country, and one says five times a week, my God, isn't that just like Chekhov? You know, of the lassitude or the languor or the bizarre, inbred, magnificent understanding of life, or of the ongoing droll relationships. And it all feels like that wonderful, long, 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 endless summer evening in Vermont, and has that kind of rhythm to it. And that's what I always felt about Chekhov, and that's what I was trying to bring forward in a English translation stroke adaptation.
I'm wondering if you can remember any of the transliteration that you used and what you wrote based on that, any of the lines that came out of that.
There's a speech in The Cherry Orchard where Gayev, who's the brother of, I guess, Madame Renevskaya, who owns The Cherry Orchard, and he's talking to his bookcase. This is a speech that happens in the middle of the night, and Gayev, he tends to give speeches. He's tends to go on at length at the drop of a hat, and he's talking about himself, as he usually is, and he says, "I am a man of the 80s. Who praises that time? No one. But I lived through it and gained convictions and suffered for them. And not for nothing does the peasant love me. Why? I know his ways. I know him." And the girl says, "Oh, uncle, please shut up." So what I was trying to do in that speech, I guess, is what I'm trying to do throughout, is to gain some, get some dramatic rhythm into the speech. And the Italians have a proverb to translate as to betray.
Now, the line, "And not for nothing does the peasant love me," that isn't the way people normally speak. Did you mean that to sound unlike normal conversation? Because it's a speech that he's making, more or less?
Well, actually, it's a feminine ending on a line of iambic pentameter, it seems to me. That I think, well, it's, to me, that is the way that people speak. I mean, here's a guy who's a rather stilted guy, and he's writing in late Victorian times in 1896, I believe, speaking of the time gone by. So if I'm going to be that guy, which is what I have to do if I'm going to write about that guy, that's the way I would speak if I'm living in 1896 and speaking about the days gone by.
Right, so you were writing it for the period. Now, you mentioned iambic pentameter. Do you often write in iambic pentameter?
I think so, because it seems to me that's the way that people speak.
Is that true? Is that the way that people speak? Is that true? Is that the way that people speak?
Well, it seems to me that that's how people speak. See?
It seems to me that that's how people speak. Was that iambic?
Yeah.
What was iambic about?
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's a line, a perfect line of iambic pentameter.
But pentameter means that there'd be 10 syllables, right?
No, five.
Five.
But look here. Now, I could sit and talk to you all day. But finally, at the end, what would we say? That you and I had sat and that we spoke. But what we'd spoken of, what would that be? The time, the place, the radio, the day. Okay, so see, here I'm on my way to a sonnet. That's all iambic pentameter.
And for people who don't remember, what iambic pentameter is, that kind of like loping, every other syllable has an accent sound?
It's iambic pentameter. Iam means it's a foot in the of short, long, short, long, short, long, short, long, short, long. You put five of those feet together. Iam just means that foot, short, long. And pentameter just means there's five of them.
So do you think about that when you're speaking, when you're just having a conversation, whether it's iambic or not?
No.
Just when you're writing, you do.
Yeah. None of us think about it, but we tend to speak that way. I mean, most of the blues is written that way, too. I hate to see that evening sun goes down. Mm-hmm. That's iambic pentameter.
So do you read a lot of Shakespeare, who wrote an iambic pentameter, or is that kind of irrelevant to why you do it?
Well, I don't read a lot of Shakespeare because I find, and maybe you've had this experience, there aren't enough pictures.
That's an interesting criticism.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So what do you read then?
Oh, I read everything. I read everything I can get my hands on. Uh-huh. I'd like to read a lot of trash, especially in the summer, and I'd like to read a lot of novelists, a lot of American and British literature.
Now, what kind of trash do you enjoy?
Oh, I like it all. Like Tom Clancy, I eat that stuff up.
Really?
Oh, sure.
The espionage stuff?
All of that stuff. I love it.
Now, you wouldn't want to make a movie of one of his books, right? I mean, you wouldn't be interested on that level, would you?
Sure, why not? I mean, I love genre movies. I think that's what the movies are good for. They're good for melodrama, and they're good for suspense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the gangster film, the science fiction film, the conspiracy film. I love all those forms.
Of course, you're the last person anyone would get for it, right? Like, we're doing a high-tech espionage thriller. Let's get David Mamet to direct.
Well, I don't know. Probably. I mean, I've written a lot of that stuff, it seems to me. I wrote The Untouchables as a genre film, gangster film.
But that's more in your territory, because it's like the urban, hard-boiled type of thing, you know. Urban crime as opposed to high-tech espionage.
Yeah, you're right. I don't know what got into me.
Okay. David Mamet is my guest, and he has a new collection of essays called Make Believe Town. In an essay that is about writing in your new collection, you say, I really like this, writing in my experience consists of long periods of hanging out, punctuated by the fugue of remorse at the loss of one's powers, and wonder at occasional output in spite of that loss. Do you still feel that way about writing?
Yeah, and I heard something, in fact, on NPR the other day. Somebody was being interviewed, some writer, and he said that that one can only be a poet for the moment that one is writing the last line of a poem. He said before that, one is a failed poet, and after that, one is an ex-poet. Isn't that good?
It's very good. What jobs have you failed at before you became a well-known writer?
Oh, I think I failed at most of them.
What were they?
Well, I started out, I wanted to lay the groundwork, this being America, so I started out with about 16 years of failing at being a student. And then
yes.
I wasn't a very good cab driver. And then I did all of those menial jobs that I liked work. I did a lot of working in restaurants as a waiter and as a busboy and doing short order stuff. I liked that very much. I think I was pretty good at it.
Where did you drive a cab?
In Chicago.
Where it must have been interesting for you to, usually the cabbie is the eccentric talker. But In this case, you were probably more the listener and listened to all the eccentric talkers in the back seat.
I don't know. I might have been. I think I was probably just driving a cab.
Mm-hmm. Was it dangerous?
Well, I got held up a couple of times. After the second time, I stopped. But I think I just stopped because I became lazy or something. It was a great job. I mean, you go to work in the morning with absolutely no money in your pockets, and 15 minutes later, you had enough for breakfast. It was terrific. And also, at that time, we were driving the Checker Marathon cabs, which are those old big yellow cabs that everybody of my age anyway remembers. And they were the only place to get warm in the Chicago winter. They were so wonderfully. It was a great car. The heater was so great you could drive all day in your t-shirt.
So, did anything surprise you about how you reacted to being held up?
I think I was kind of stunned. In fact, I was rather stunned both times. And sure, take the money and go. I never thought that the guy was really going to hurt me, but perhaps he was. The first time I thought he was going to hurt me. The second time I didn't think he was going to hurt me, and then I ran into a cop almost immediately afterward. Maybe I've told you this story before, and I said, "That fellow just held me up. I think he's running across over there. You might be able to catch him." And he said, insisted on taking my name and everything. And he took my name. He said, "Hey, wait a second. Are you related to Bernie Mamet?" I said, "Yeah, he's my dad." He said, "We bought your house." I said, "Get out." He said, "Yeah, we bought your house on Euclid Avenue." He said, "Did it used to have that cowboy wallpaper?" He said, "I grew up with that wallpaper." I said, "Et cetera, et cetera." Well, the guy was getting away.
David Mamet, his new book is called Make Believe Town, Essays and Remembrances. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, The Boys in the Band. We talk with playwright Mark Crowley about the off-Broadway revival of his much-celebrated and much-criticized play about gay men examining their lives. TV critic David Bianculli reviews Signal to Noise, and Ed Ward tells us about the pop music where Detroit and Berlin meet. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, PBS begins presenting a three-part series called Signal to Noise, Life with Television. It's a program that seems tailor-made for our TV critic David Bianculli, who's always pushing TV to look at itself more seriously. And he was very excited about Signal to Noise until he saw it.
What's the point? Why does PBS even try stuff like this? Let me explain what's bugging me here in general before I get down to specifics. What really bothers me about TV is that despite how powerful and popular it is, it doesn't give itself the time of day, or at least not much time on TV. There are three different Siskel and Ebert-type TV shows out there where critics discuss the week's new movies, and even a handful of shows about new books, but almost nothing about television. One problem, if you're talking about a show looking at what's on TV that night or that week, is how to justify it to the network that televises it. A movie critic giving thumbs up to a new film is one thing. A TV critic telling viewers to change channels is a lot more problematic. That's where PBS should, or at least could, come in. But it hasn't, even though a series looking closely at TV would be at least as meaningful as another PBS show about gardening or home repair. Okay, so that annoys me. But at least PBS steps up every few years and takes a swing at looking at TV more generally. The problem here, though, is that every time it swings, it strikes out. The mammoth documentary series he did a few years back, with the generic title of Television, was a mess, and was about as condescending as William F. Buckley. And now we have the brand new Signal to Noise, which is subtitled Life with Television. This one, I expected, would right the wrongs and treat TV with the intelligence it deserves. Boy, was I wrong. Instead, producer Cara Mertes has gathered together more than a dozen different producers and let them present their own short pieces in their own individual voices. The result is a disjointed chain with no coherent theme or message and with an awful lot of weak links. The most awful of them all, by far, is producer Sherry Milner's love letter to Roseanne, the sitcom and the actress. What passes for clever in her piece on Roseanne is to show Sherry watching Roseanne, falling asleep on the couch, and waking up on the set of Roseanne. Remember, as you're listening to this, that this isn't something dredged up from Entertainment Tonight or the E! Entertainment Network. This is a treatise on TV as served up by the good old public broadcasting service.
Here I am! I'm transported into Roseanne's living room! This is the couch! The couch she sits on like this! I could just live here, don't you think? It's got everything you'd need.
That is the beauty of this house. It is a house, and then it's not a house. It's the house of dreams. So up the staircase, what's up there is television.
I don't think anything on TV has made me this ill since I saw A Very Brady Christmas or the Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island. And while there are three or four decent to good reports in Signal to Noise, especially Michael Cho's piece on how local TV news is gathered and presented, most of the pieces in the series are old news or too obvious, and are only a few notches above the Roseanne piece. And trust me, that's way too many notches too low.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, the boys in the band. This is Fresh Air. A lot of people had their first glimpse of gay life through the 1970 film The Boys and the Band.
What I am, Michael, is a 32-year-old, ugly, pockmarked Jew fairy. And if it takes me a while to pull myself together, and if I smoke a little grass before I get up the nerve to show my face to the world, it's nobody's business but my own. And how are you this evening?
Well, that'll give you a sense of what made the film so controversial. It was praised for breaking the taboo against depicting homosexuals on screen, but it was criticized for presenting stereotypical characters and dwelling on their self-hatred. The movie was written by Mart Crowley, adapted from his 1968 off-Broadway play, The Boys and the Band. A new revival is running off-Broadway. The play is included in Crowley's new book, Three Plays, and the film is about to be shown at the Philadelphia Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, where Crowley will make an appearance. The story is about a group of gay men who get together at a birthday party. The party begins with a lot of zippy wisecracking and ends with a nasty truth-telling game about their love lives in which everyone becomes emotionally undone. I asked Crowley how reaction to Boys in the Band has changed since it was first staged in 1968.
Well, you know, when it was first produced, it was prior to the Stonewall Riot and prior to what is generally accepted as the turning point for gay liberation. So the play was quite stunning at that time on a totally social level. It was the first time that a play had appeared in which there were homosexual characters who were homosexual up front from the time the curtain went up. And they just took the homosexual lifestyle for granted as a base for human experience and then went forward. It was not used as any kind of revelatory gimmick for the last act in which, it's revealed that somebody is homosexual, which had been done in plays prior to this.
Do you think there's a difference between how the character of Emery, who's the most flamboyant of the characters and the biggest queen of the characters, how he is interpreted now and how he's interpreted in the original production? Is there a difference?
I think that Emery now is more, I don't know, he's a much more defiant. His flamboyance it's clearly much more of a weapon when he completely confronts the straight character in the play or the character who is considered straight or on the fence or whatever. It's never really made totally clear. When he confronts Alan, who represents the straight world, I think it's much more clear that he uses his flamboyance as a defiance, as a weapon. And I think that the anger that is represented by that could be seen as his future, really. I mean, the rage that is contained in that flamboyance, I think, would indicate that of all the characters, he might be the one who goes on to some sort of militancy.
One of the most famous lines in The Boys in the Band is, "Show me a happy homosexual and I'll show you a gay corpse." And the play is really so much about self-hatred. And I was wondering, when you wrote the play, if you saw the self-hatred expressed in the play as being an inherent part of homosexuality or a kind of reaction to the oppression and homophobia within society.
At the time, I was just writing from a real subconscious point of view. So it is with hindsight that I can only say that perhaps it was the pressures of society which formed my own opinion and is reflected in the play. I mean, at that time, in 1967, homosexuality was considered a mental illness by the American Medical Association. The Catholic Church told you that you were going to hell if you lived this lifestyle. I think my parents expected me to get married and to have children and to keep the name of the family going. I was the last male of the line. And I felt this burden, a responsibility toward my family, the burden of God, as I was Catholic and had been to Catholic school all my life and taught the teachings of the Catholic Church. And then I was emotionally confused about my sexuality, my psychosexuality, if you will, and I started to see a psychiatrist about that. And at that time, one of the alternatives was to go into psychoanalysis in order to be, quote-unquote, cured of one's homosexuality. That was an option. I don't know that I considered that, but I just had to discuss this with somebody because the sexual confusion was quite disturbing to me. And
so
all of these elements are in the play, particularly in the character of Michael, which I always consider to be the most autobiographical character and the one who has the biggest problem with sexual confusion and self-loathing and so forth, the thing that most of the other characters do not have and I think have been labeled as having, hopefully in a calmer climate such as today, one can look back on the play and see that characters like Emery, whom we've been talking about, does not have any problem with his homosexuality whatsoever, nor do the lovers in the play.
I'd like to play a short excerpt of the film The Boys in the Band.
Mm-hmm.
And this is toward the very end of the movie where the birthday party has kind of fallen apart. Everybody has emotionally torn each other apart.
Mm.
And the birthday boy, as he's leaving, played by Leonard Fry, tells Michael that he's basically a sad and pathetic man.
Mm-hmm.
And you've just said Michael is the character most based on you. Why don't we play this little talk?
All right.
You're a homosexual and you don't want to be. But there's nothing you can do to change it. Not all your prayers to your God. Not all the analysis you can buy in all the years you've got left to live. You may very well one day be able to know a heterosexual life, if you want it desperately enough, if you pursue it with the fervor with which you annihilate. But you'll always be homosexual as well. Always, Michael. Always. Until the day you die.
What were you thinking about when you wrote those lines?
Well, I think Harold is
Harold was the Leonard Fry character.
Harold is the
speech.
Leonard Fry character and the most worthy adversary, if you will, to Michael. I think he's the one who tells the truth, who tells it like it is, who tells Michael that he's a sad and pathetic man because he won't face his true identity and that he won't come out of the closet and stop pretending and stop trying to pass, if you will. Harold just uses Michael's own weapon, which is an attack on everybody else's life for not announcing their homosexuality. He uses it against him, and he wins, so to speak, because of his simplicity and his truthfulness, his honesty. I think he really causes Michael to make some sort of a choice, or that's the intention that I had at the end. Michael could go back in the closet or he could come out, but at that point he's been told what the quote-unquote truth is by Harold.
The actors who were in the original Off-Broadway production also starred in the movie version of Boys in the Band. Did their appearance in a gay-themed movie and play affect their career after the Boys in the Band?
It's something that generally you can say no. There were a couple of actors in the cast who felt that they were stigmatized by it. they seem to be the actors who had the least success with getting other roles. So naturally, they needed to blame something. But it certainly had no effect on Leonard Fry's career. He went on to get the role of Mottle the Tailor in the film version of Fiddler on the Roof and was nominated for an Academy Award for that part. That was certainly, he was an innocent Jewish boy in that play, and he was not playing a homosexual at all. Lawrence Luckinbill has gone on to work in all sorts of plays. He was just recently on Broadway in John Robin Bates' new play, A Fair Country. Cliff Gorman, immediately after The Boys in the Band, not quite immediately after, but soon after, got the lead in Lenny, the Lenny Bruce story. He was certainly not a gay comic. He had quite acerbic things to say about gays in his comedy act at the time, as I recall. And it didn't do anything damaging to Cliff's career. Peter White, who played the straight guy in it, is now a regular on the television series ER. He's the head of the hospital, and he's making a movie with Albert Brooks and Debbie Reynolds at the moment. It didn't damage his career. There were a couple of guys who didn't get work and whose careers seemed to fade, and they did take the stance that the play had damaged them. Whether that's true or not, I don't know.
Do you think that your play, The Boys in the Band, ended up being, in a way, an argument to yourself to accept your own homosexuality instead of feeling bad about it?
Perhaps. It's hard for me to really have a definite overview of it. It was done so spontaneously. It was done so without any kind of calculation that, you know, whatever it was about, it was a completely subconscious act on my part. At that point in time, I thought I was just writing a play that expressed my own confusion and rage, and I had no idea what would become of it. At the time, people who knew what I was doing sort of thought maybe I should brace myself that it would never be performed. You know, they thought it was an outrageous notion of mine to even do this, and they wanted me not to have some sort of nervous breakdown if my work was rejected. Ultimately, maybe I would have if I never could have got the play on the boards, but it worked out differently.
Mark Crowley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you very, very much.
There's a new off-Broadway revival of Mark Crowley's play, The Boys in the Band. The play is included in his new book, Three Plays, published by Allison, and his 1970 movie adaptation will be shown next week at the Philadelphia Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. Crowley will introduce the screenings. Coming up, techno. This is Fresh Air. Some of the most popular music associated with Europe had its origins in the U.S. Rock historian Ed Ward, who's now based in Germany, has this report on the history of techno music. ¶¶
the contemporary pop genres, perhaps none is so misunderstood in America as that which has come to be known as techno. As far as the average American music listener is concerned, techno is anything with electronics and a beat, and it usually comes from Germany or England. And despite the fact that this music is a major part of the pop landscape in Europe, it's almost totally failed to catch on in the States. That's why most people are amazed to learn that techno started as not only an American musical form, but a black one at that. In the mid-70s, the Detroit black music scene was a seriously weird place. Dominated by the twin poles of Parliament Funkadelic and their loony space opera fantasy, and the equally glitzy disco scene, it seemed like a hard thing to break into for a young creative musician. Rock radio in Detroit was also fairly odd, and things got played there that didn't get played anywhere else in the country. Kraftwerk, an odd German duo playing synthesizers, were on the very margins of the rock world. Yet in both New York, where Trans Europe Express would be reworked into Planet Rock, and Detroit, they had black fans. In the hands of New York's Afrika Bambaataa and others, this led to a small offshoot of disco that became known as electro. Meanwhile, in Chicago, another form of disco emerged, a high-energy sound called house. House never really took off outside Chicago until the early 80s when European DJs started playing it, but in Detroit, the rivalry with Chicago was enough to spawn a house scene a few years later. Inner City, a Detroit house group, was moderately successful, and among their producers was Kevin Saunderson. Saunderson took an electro approach with the group, using the primitive synthesizers at his disposal, and other young would-be dance music producers took note. Among them was Juan Atkins, who had worked with Saunderson on Inner City. Techno music, an early Juan Atkins record, gave the genre its name, and suddenly Detroit's disco sounded very odd indeed. Hardcore, perhaps a half dozen people, started making stripped-down, minimalistic records like Rhythm is Rhythm's It Is What It Is, and releasing them under a multiplicity of names to make the scene seem bigger than it was. Perhaps the most important record to come out of this scene was Model 500's No UFOs in 1986. aggressive, hard-edged, and rhythmically driven, it immediately struck a chord in German ears, since it was an obvious update of Kraftwerk's sound. The discos in cities like Berlin and Frankfurt took to this music immediately, and a bond was established between Berlin and Detroit that remains to this day. A new generation of Detroiters like Underground Resistance headed straight for Germany to release their records, and Berlin DJs like Dr. Mata produced their own records in Detroit style. Today, techno is perhaps the first truly international pop style due to its lack of vocals, and it's fragmented into styles like trance, ambient, and jungle. In the U.S., Juan Atkins and his friends have had to buy time on a Detroit radio station just to get their music played in their hometown, but their invention now grooves the whole planet.
Ed Ward writes about music from Berlin. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Louisa Shafia, and Tracy Tannenbaum. Assistance from Phoebe Vanskoy. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.